First bill is a public hearing, House Bill 2047. Karen Steele, attorney representing the Mexican consulate. Mr. Shepherd, do you want to come up at the same time?
Good morning, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Steele. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Consul General Martha Ortiz de Rosas. She's the Consul General of the Mexican Consulate in Portland, Oregon, and she sends her apologies for not being able to appear personally before you this morning. We have been involved for the last couple of years in the Attorney General's work group on the Vienna Convention, and we greatly appreciated the opportunity to work with the other members of that work group. The work group produced some fruit, and I think that Mr. Shepherd will be telling you somewhat about that, as well as his interpretation of the resulting bills that are now before the committee. Unfortunately, I am unable to provide the Mexican consulate's position on the two bills before the committee this morning. We have presently pending in the International Court of Justice litigation between the government of Mexico and the government of the United States, and it is specifically on the issue of the Vienna Convention. Given that litigation, we are presently in a position where we need to have everything approved by the government of Mexico prior to providing it to legislative committees and bodies such as yourselves. So at this point in time, I do have testimony or a submission currently in Mexico pending approval that I would like the opportunity to submit to this committee once it comes back, and I would expect that to happen within the next 4 to 5 days. And
you want to submit it now or just when it comes back for approval?
Chair, I would have to wait until it comes back for approval if that would be acceptable.
That's fine.
And I guess the last thing would be to offer the consulate's assistance to this committee and any members in gathering additional materials or anything along that line that the committee members may want in the future.
All right. Good. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. As Ms. Steele has indicated, as long ago as 2.5 years ago, Attorney General Myers convened a working group on the subject of how to improve, frankly, compliance with the Vienna Convention on Consular Affairs. That is a treaty that the United States and most nations have entered into. As a treaty, of course, it is the supreme law of the land here in the United States, and so as a treaty, it imposes obligations, enforceable at law, as a legal obligation of the United States. The treaty requires, under certain circumstances, that foreign nationals who are taken into custody for a variety of purposes by an enforcement authority, either civil or criminal, be provided with notice of that foreign national's right under the treaty to contact his or her consulate to obtain assistance from that consular official. And as I say, the purpose of the work group has been to try and give substance to the commandment, the general commandment that's provided in the treaty. And House Bill 2047 is part of that effort. House Bill 2047 does two things, basically and fairly simply. First, it requires that the Board on Public Safety Standards and Training include training for police officers in the requirements of the treaty, so that that would then be required as a matter of statute to be part of the trained curriculum for law enforcement officers. And secondly, House Bill 2047 in the A. N. Gross version also requires that notices be given at certain stages of civil commitment proceedings because persons taken into custody on civil commitment under civil commitment proceedings also are entitled to notice under the treaty. And so that is simply what House Bill 2047 does. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that Ms. Steele's in a difficult position because her client is currently engaged in litigation, and so it's hard for her to comment on the on the bill itself. I would say to the committee that I'm not aware of any opposition to House Bill 1047.
Well, and this was a subject of some of our interim work, and I think Senator Abel Gordley brought this to the Judiciary Committee's attention during the 2001 session. It looks to me like we've done a substantial amount of work on it. Now, the issues before the International Court, I don't know that I want to delve into what the legal effect of the judgment by that court is with respect to the treaty, because I wouldn't know. But I'm assuming that if it does have the force of law in the United States in terms of enforcement of the treaty, et cetera, that those issues would be, I guess, the law of the land, notwithstanding, you know, the fact that these bills maybe not address those specific issues. So I guess what the chair would like to do is move the bills and get them out of the committee. Now, I know the Mexican consulate may have some other issues they'd like to raise, but I think that those issues can be raised at a different time in a different bill. And that's my general direction, simply because we're now getting to the latter part of the session where the committee is getting a lot of pressure from the Senate president and the presiding officers in the other chamber to begin to narrow the scope of what we're doing. And I don't want to lose the work of the interim committees and the House, if that's okay with y'all. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, two observations. One, we intend to continue the work of the work group. It's been very productive and I think very useful.
Right.
And two, it has made a lot of progress even outside the statutory context as a result of the work group's efforts contributed to significantly by the Mexican consulate. Jail managers in Oregon will be providing, as part of their standard procedure in all of those jurisdictions, they will be providing notice under the treaty, which we have a dispute about whether that's sufficient to comply with the requirements of the treaty, but I think everyone agrees that it's a significant step forward.
Right, and actually I think that seems like a good compromise in the sense that the discussion is going to be ongoing. And I think that the legislature, in passing these bills, will be interested in how effective the Board of Police Safety Standards and Training is in terms of doing the training and to what degree this work is being accomplished, at the street level. And I think there's some general good that can come out of this, particularly in terms of relationships with the local consulates. As many years as I worked on the street, I don't think I've ever had contact with the Mexican consulate. The Lebanese consulate, interestingly, because his home was burglarized and I took the burglary report. But I think bringing a level of cognizance, in the minds of law enforcement officers regarding the issues is a good thing. So the training's positive. And that's my perspective, and particularly given, just the volume of migration of different peoples into the United States. And I think that's positive. I think hopefully building good, positive relationships. And I think I've said this before, I did have a murder case involving citizens of Mexico and, trying to get through the Mexican consulate to get information from Mexico with respect to whereabouts is very important oftentimes in criminal investigations to get witnesses back into the country that are critical to the case. So the better relationship we can develop, I think that's a positive, a very positive thing. So. And far be it for me to start delving into international law issues. I have a hard enough time with our own laws. Committee, you have comments? Or?
I agree with you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's really good to have the work continuing, but I would see no reason to hold this up.
All right. If you don't mind, I'm going to do a work session on House Bill 2047.
Chairman?
Senator Bree.
I would move House Bill 2047 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bree now moves House Bill 2047 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation unamended. I assume there are no referrals to Ways and Means.
No.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? No objection. The motion passes. And the next bill up, I believe, is related. I think I'll carry that bill. And let's move down to 2091. We'll do a public hearing on House Bill 2091. And we have Ms. Steele again, who is limited in what she can say. And Tim Travis. Who
Good morning again, Chairman. Again, Karen Steele on behalf of Martha Ortiz de Rosas, Mexican Consul General of the Mexican Consulate in Portland, Oregon. Very similar situation, actually an identical situation, in that we have participated in a work group that culminated in the bill before you this morning, and once again, I'm unable to provide substantive comment due to the pending litigation in the International Court of Justice. So we have appreciated the work group. We appreciate efforts by Oregon to comply with the Vienna Convention, and I think I should stop my comments right there.
All right. All right. Mr. Travis, sir.
Excuse me. Timothy Travis. I'm the Court Improvement Manager of the Oregon Judicial Department, and I headed up the work group that put together House Bill 2091. The distinction between House Bill 2091 and House Bill 2047 is that House Bill 2047 deals with situations where a foreign national is taken into custody for committing a crime. House Bill 2091 deals, instead of with Article 36 of the treaty, with Article 37B of the treaty. This covers a situation when a foreign national is the subject of a guardianship or some protective proceeding. In these particular situations, whether it is a person who someone seeking to get a guardianship of, a conservatorship of, who is an adult, or whether it's a child who has been taken into care by the Protective Services Agency on an abuse or neglect situation. In both of these situations, notice to that person is not of much avail. So the treaty provides that notice will automatically be given to the consul when there is a guardianship action or a dependency action. In a criminal action, you notify the defendant that he or she has the right to talk to their consul. In this particular case, you automatically notify the consul of the pending of the action. Now, how we've done that is all of these actions in Oregon begin with a petition, whether that petition is filed by a private individual or a government agency. And so what we did was we simply said that a part of the statute that governs serving the petition includes that the petition will be served on the consul. So by serving the consul with the petition, the notification required by the treaty is made. And that's simply what House Bill 2091 does. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Yeah, the service of the petition, I assume, will be given so that there's adequate time, I assume, to, I don't know if the consul would want to represent the parties there or be present. And
The normal law of service is that if someone who is required to be served is not served in a timely manner, then the proceedings can be delayed so that that person has an opportunity to make a meaningful contribution.
Okay. Committee, questions? There are no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Work session, House Bill 2091. Senator Brady.
Before I make a motion, I saw the piece from the Department of Human Services saying it wasn't in the governor's budget, but I don't see it fiscal.
I don't think it makes any difference if it's in the governor's budget. It's international law, and it's a treaty of the United States, and oh well.
No, I understand that, but I didn't see it fiscal. Maybe Council could say why that was, if there was an impact.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, like the good chair said, it's already the law of the land. So, and also, as far as policy goes, I think it'd be probably difficult for the whole system to really accurately say what the fiscal is, because through the notification here, you may have kids that would otherwise be wards of the state of Oregon going back to their families in Mexico or other countries like that. So, I mean, when you get into weighing the cost, you'd also have to consider that.
It was just a question.
It's a good question, but again, it is the law of the land, and the assumption is that they're supposed to be complying already. So.
Makes me feel very good about my next move, Mr. Chairman, which is to move House Bill 2091 to the Senate floor with a brief pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2091 to the floor of the Senate with a brief pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Motion passes. And I'd like to ask that Senator Gordley carry this bill, since she brought the issue to our attention. If she declines, then I'll assign this to Senator Ringo to carry. That's okay. All right. Thank you. And I want to thank the Mexican consulate for working with us throughout the interim. And we'll continue to follow through these issues, and hopefully it presents a positive impact in the state. So thank you very much. All right. House Bill 2050. Public hearing. We have Walt Beglau. Did I even come close?
Beglau.
Okay.
Morning, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Walt Beglau. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. House Bill 2050 is a great change and a great idea. It places concise emphasis on an area of abuse involving methamphetamine that we're seeing on a day-to-day basis in homes where children are living. I want to bring my support of that through the association. I want to point out one concern I have that down the road it may be construed to limit exposure only to methamphetamine and not other controlled substances. Right now, the reporting law under the subsection involving neglect would include kids exposed to any illegal drug activity in any home. So with that point in mind, I do want to lend our support of this. From a training standpoint, we're going out and saying anytime there's a child in a home where there's controlled substances being used or there's some level of manufacturing or delivery, we're certainly going to be involved in the abuse statute.
All right. And this expressly puts the methamphetamine issue into the statute. The other issues you'd have to argue, I assume, from some other theory. And certainly, you're trying to argue abuse or neglect. If you didn't have a methamphetamine home, you had a marijuana grow or some other kind of operation. As far as neglect, you'd have to argue, I think, of the totality of the circumstances.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Is that right? But it doesn't preclude you from making that argument. It's just maybe a little bit more complex.
No, it's not.
Okay.
You know, I would point out, Mr. Chair, if I could, in the handbook statewide that they use for training for the mandatory child abuse statute, they talk about in neglect exposing a child to illegal activity, which is exposing a child to parental drug abuse, which would include all of those. I do a lot of training on this, and we make sure that mandatory reporters understand that any child exposed to methamphetamine, including other controlled substances, would clearly be a reportable offense.
All right. Okay. Any questions, Mr. Beckley?
Mr. Chairman, we did something last session. I think I was actually a sponsor of it to enhance the penalties for having methamphetamine around children. Could you remind me?
We did, and my memory is a little bit shy of it. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Counsel, you're supposed to be talking about
it.
Chair, members of the committee, you're right. We did do something, and I think we enhanced the penalty, but I'd have to go back.
I think that's right. And for some reason, my mind is thinking that, you know, termination of parental rights issues, but
Mr. Chair, we did. We worked that bill pretty extensively on the House side, and we did increase the, or lower the bar for termination of parental rights when methamphetamine
was
involved.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you for the...
Mr. Chair. The good senator is right. What we did is it was for the issue of termination of parental rights.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Bigelow. Thank you. And Bob Jensen.
Thank you.
Oh, Representative Bob Jensen. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I would have called you up first had I recognized your
real name. Well, it was easier for me because you've got the explanation of what the bill was without my having to do that sort of thing.
Great.
And... Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58, and as I frequently explain, House District 58 includes the metropolitan areas of Hermiston and Pendleton and the smaller cities surrounding or in the immediate area there. And I have, Mr. Chairman, an apology, I think, that is owed to the committee. I was surprised when I got here this morning to discover that the amendment that I had proposed hadn't gotten to the committee, and I think you do have it now, but the author's intention was that that come to the committee, and apparently I erred in following through on that, and asked for your understanding of my mistake. Basically, it's a very simple amendment. It's a issue that I proposed when we heard this on the House side, but we wanted to send it over to here to you to move the process along. And the issue is very simply that we add member of the Legislative Assembly to the list of those responsible for reporting of this activity. Now, first off, that is very serious concern on my part, because as members of the Legislative Assembly, we often do constituent work that brings us into contact with issues like this, and I don't think we should be any more immune from the obligation of reporting than should other folks, like police officers and so forth, to come in contact with it. And I would suggest that there is also precedent for this, and I don't know whether you have yet heard House Bill 2672, but its one has to do with abuse as far as elders are concerned, and there is a section in that particular law existing at the present time that any public official who comes in contact with elderly persons in the performance of the official's duties is mandatory reporting. So it does appear that this, hopefully that the amendment that I'm asking you to consider is consistent with other statutes that we have as far as this general area of reporting of abuse. Right. And that's all I have with that. I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions of the good representative from Eastern Oregon? There are no questions.
Thank you very much.
Work session, House Bill 2050.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
I did have a question of counsel. I like the amendment a lot, but I wanted to ask counsel if there's something we're not doing whether that would cause any problems with other statutes or...
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, should not cause problems for other statutes. It's simply a policy decision.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Reno.
I just have a question for the committee. I think most of the current list of members or folks who must report stand in some sort of trust relationship, and whether it's as an attorney or as some sort of physician or teacher. And I guess would ask where we go with the reporting requirement. I mean, because in some ways the list could never end, and it really is probably just good citizenship to report a situation where a child is placed in harm's way. But I pose that as a question, and just would appreciate any wisdom on that.
Well, Senator Ringo, you see, peace officers and firefighters, emergency technicians have a duty to report. They don't have that trust.
That's you're right.
Relationship, but they do have an official function that brings them in contact with the public. So, I think personally, that Representative Jensen's comments are probably appropriate, because we do come into contact with individuals that perhaps need to have the services of SCF. Senator Walker.
My constituents usually don't invite me to their meth labs. Just as it hasn't happened yet.
But as you go door to door, you may run into something that you go, you know what, something's not right here.
It smells like
Chairman, we should extend it to candidates as well.
This would apply only to incumbent members seeking re-election. Senator Walker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, well, that's true. I mean, you can go to a door and you know the smell of a meth lab if you've had any dealing with that and with police work. It smells like a diaper pail 50 times over. It's incredibly stinky, like urine. But the question I had is that if we're going to add us to this statute, is this on the child abuse? Yes, it is. Okay. I think that's appropriate. We do hear a lot of constituent work that involves children and families, and I think it's appropriate.
And this will apply to the whole statute, not just that.
Yeah. That's what I was just checking.
All right. Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the -2 amendment to House Bill 2050.
Okay. Senator Burdick moves the adoption of the A2 amendment to House Bill 2050. Is there any further discussion? No. Any objection? No objection. Motion passes.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Burdick.
I would move House Bill 2050 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Burdick moves House Bill 2050 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Who wants to volunteer for that one? Senator Burdick. Beat Senator Walker to the punch here.
Senator Walker, I will defer to you since you're our contestant here.
Do you want me to carry this?
If you'd like, otherwise I will do it.
Go ahead, Senator Burdick.
Senator Burdick's going to get that.
It's a warm and fuzzy bill. It's very nice.
All right, great. House Bill 2110, public hearing, Ronell Schenkel, Department of Justice. She has the A6? Somebody else moved. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning. For the record, Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 2110. And since this is second chamber on the bill and we've spent some time with some of you, if I might just start with an overview and get some direction from the committee on how much detail you want. Let me begin by telling you House Bill 2110, as drafted by the Department of Justice, is what we call a housekeeping bill. The child support statutes are fairly comprehensive, rather technical, and it is very common to find pieces of the law that the language needs to be adjusted to be completely legally sufficient or more clear. Having said that, there are 14 sections in this housekeeping bill, all of which fall under one of two categories. It's either a minor process adjustment, nothing substantive, or some technical language clarification. I will go through my testimony, if you wish, Chairman, and just sort of not through all the detail, but tell you this is language, this is customer service. Would that be helpful to hit it that way?
Sure.
Okay. Under the process adjustments, Section 1, 23-160, this is actually a friendly amendment that was offered in the House side by the Employment Department. Tamara Brickman is in the room if you want some information about this, but the short story is it's a federal compliance issue that they needed to adjust the statute related to withholding through their department related to spousal support.
Right. Hang on just a second because I'm not following you. What was that in reference to? Is that, that's in the bill as it came over?
In the bill. That is correct, Chairman. It's Section 1.
Okay, great. Thank you. I just want to make sure I'm tracking.
I appreciate that. And I'm not going numerical because I've divided them into process versus technical, if you don't mind. So
okay,
I will
great.
Try not to speed ahead too fast.
I found your cheat sheet. So now
good.
Now
Section 3 is the next process adjustment. This is a customer service piece I will point out. It's ORS 25-125. It has to do with the child support program's ability to temporarily suspend enforcement when a modification is pending. Right now, the language is tied to modifications to zero due to a custody change. We want to take the zero out in any time a modification is being done related specifically to a custody change that might result in a credit balance. We think we should have the ability to temporarily suspend enforcement so that we don't cause an overpayment scenario. So that, while it is just a process adjustment to an existing process, it is a good customer service piece. Also in Section 3, there are a couple of language adjustments that were picked up. Sections 4 and 5, I believe Legislative Council put them in there, 25-125 again, and I think it's due to some of the sunset language in the statutes. Section 7 is also a process adjustment, and it's another customer service piece. Granted, it's minor, but it is a piece. It's ORS 25396. That has to do with income withholding, and more specifically, exceptions to income withholding, which are fairly restrictive. Right now, one of the criteria to get an exception and, for example, set up payment through a bank account rather than through withholding is that you have to bring your case current. You have to pay off all of your arrears. What we'd like to do is broaden that a little bit so that for those folks that have been paying timely, then end up in a legal action, and sometimes the legal process itself causes you to go slightly behind on your case and be in arrears. We'd like them to still qualify, and they would set up the bank account to pay the monthly plus something towards arrears. Section 8 is clarifying process. It's not a change in process. Section 9 is another customer service piece and actually a little bit of federal compliance. It's related to state tax offsets, and it would have us change the notice we send to the obligors to go out before we send it to the Department of Revenue instead of after we've done so and the money's already been intercepted. So the notice will go out earlier in the process. Section 11, which is ORS 416425, is again just a language adjustment, not a change in process, but a clarifying piece. And Section 14, again, was related to the friendly amendments from the Employment Department. The remaining sections are literally technical language adjustments, either changing cross-references or taking out statutory sites that are no longer appropriate. There isn't anything substantive in there, but they are things that are very important to the attorneys that practice in this area of law, so I don't mean to diminish them in any way, but I won't spend your time going over them unless you have specific questions. The other handout that you got from me is a short summary of what are the A6 amendments. In the House chamber, after the public hearing, Chair Williams had us go and work with all the partners that we could on amendments, and we worked out several things with the Judicial Department as well as Legal Aid Services and Bureau of Labor and Industry. However, we missed a piece or perhaps didn't clearly understand the piece on Bureau of Labor and Industry. They have some amendments before you today.
And then the A6 amendments are whose?
The A6 are from the Department of Justice.
Right.
The A8s, Chairman, is contained the Department of Justice's plus the correct BOLI, the correct language from BOLI.
All right, hang on a second. A6, DOJ.
Correct.
A8, DOJ, plus BOLI.
That is correct.
All right, so you guys are working with BOLI on this, correct?
I saw these just a few minutes ago. They completely contain our amendments and have her additional amendments, and we are fine with those, Chairman.
Right.
Marsha Ohlmeyer is in the room.
Gone.
That would be correct.
A8 in front. Okay.
The primary piece you'll see in here from the Department of Justice is a result of another bill, House Bill 2696, which is related to the definition of public assistance in the Department of Human Services. We discovered that there are some references to their definition in our child support statutes, and then we also have a public assistance definition specific for child support purposes. So these amendments strive to go through and use the child support definition consistently rather than the broader one from DHS. Our concern when we saw that other bill is that potentially will be a much broader group of people, food stamps and other types of cases that are not mandatory referrals for child support, and we didn't want to inadvertently pick up some cases that were not necessary. So a lot of it resulted from that bill. There is one other piece that came from work on an additional bill, House Bill 2095. But again, they're technical, clarifying language.
Okay. Questions, anyone? Senator Ringo?
I was just going to ask, it sounds like you've worked with all the government folks, but has the family law section of the bar, they looked at all these amendments?
Chairman and Senator Ringo, yes, the people that specifically had issues and we did some ad hoc work with were the ones I mentioned. We also have been sharing our amendments and our testimony with two representatives from the family law section of the Oregon State Bar, and their position is basically neutral on these housekeeping amendments. We have one child support advocacy group. It's Oregon Men's Association that we keep in the loop on this, and also then Employment Department hearings officers that hear our cases.
Thank you.
All right. No other questions, Ronell. Thank you very much. Marsha formula, or hopefully I didn't butcher your name too. But it happens a lot.
Chairman Menes, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I don't believe that much needs to be said because I believe Ms. Schenkel really covered the situation there. -A6 amendments include all of their concerns, and the -A8 amendments include theirs plus ours. As she mentioned, we apparently did not clearly communicate some of the technical pieces of amendments that we thought needed to be made to conform some of our existing statutes with the child support changes. And so those were added to the A8 amendments. Specifically, what it concerns is there's an existing statute which prohibits discrimination against a child support obligor by an employer, and that's a long-standing current statute. The rights and remedies in that statute needed to be consistent with the rights and remedies of a new protection that's being created in House Bill 2095 having to do with medical child support obligors. And so the language that's different between A6 and A8 concerns that conforming amendment. Specifically, it can be found at pages 14, starting at line 25 on down, is the existing language of the statute 25-424-3A that talks about discrimination against a child support obligor being an unlawful employment practice. And the only change we made was to remove some additional words and add a reference to ORS 659A85, which is the corresponding statute among our statutes. And then on page 16 of the -8 amendments, in order to complete the cross-reference, beginning on line 26, you have the ORS 659A885 repeated in its entirety, the only change being on page 17 at line 22, you add ORS 25.424 to complete the cross-reference. I'd be happy to take any questions. It's one of those things, if you came on in the middle of it, it's probably not as clear to those of us who've been wrestling around with it for a few weeks now.
You've only been wrestling with it for a couple of weeks?
Seriously wrestling.
All right. Any questions by the committee? There are no questions. Marcia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman.
Testimony, Mr. Greg Warnock, Oregon Veterans Association.
Mr. Chair, Senators. Oregon Veterans Association is a war veterans association, and we're involved in proposed amendment A9. This amendment was originally originally was established as House Bill 3472, and after extensive discussions with LC, we decided to attach it to House Bill 2110 as part of the housekeeping bill. I think Dennis Hoyman, who is here to give testimony as well, can add some information about why or the importance of this particular amendment, and then I might be able to answer some questions for you as well. We're supporting this primarily, Oregon Veterans Association is supporting this primarily because it affects disabled veterans, this proposed amendment. And we'd like to insert a couple of...
Okay, go ahead.
There's several things here that we want to make sure is part of this bill, and we just wanted to be here to make our case for that if there's questions.
All right, and you're Dennis?
I'm Dennis Lyman, correct.
Okay, tell us what you have to say about it.
Chairman, other representatives, this particular bill
has been around since about 1999, and I'm involved and I work with a lot of disabled veterans and disabled people. I've been contacted by, I would say, at least over 200 personal contacts where this bill does affect. I work with drug and alcohol people. That's how I get in with the disabled. Plus, I work with the veterans centers and outreach clinics. And a lot of these stories come to me of how this bill would affect them. I have also submitted Oregon law, and I have submitted some United States Code under Authority Chapter 38, and I've also submitted Code of Federal Regulations Chapter 20, 404, 366, and these all relate to the federal government and federal law stating that we should have credit for our child support.
But why don't you explain to me what the problem is you're trying to resolve?
We've started this bill around 1999. Early in the 1990s, there is, when a person is disabled through the Social Security Administration, they take your calculations of the money that you have paid into Social Security for the years, and they give you what they call a benefit award.
They give you a what?
They give you a benefit award for the amount of years that you have paid into Social Security. One of the cases that I am more familiar with, this particular person's award comes to $1,600 a month, what his Social Security payment would be because he was disabled. Out of that $1,600 a month, he gets $1,000 a month to himself because of his disability and what he's paid into. And if he has children involved, whether it be one child or 10, that remainder of his benefit award goes to those children for child support purposes. And this goes on until the child is 18. And when that child is 18 and goes on to school, as we do in here in Oregon, we are required to still continue on with child support. But that payment from Social Security does stop at age 18 and once that child is out of high school. And
so help me understand what you're talking about. You have an award of $1,600 in this hypothetical situation, but the veteran is actually getting $1,000.
This is for any disabled person.
All right, whatever. Whatever. Follow me here. The other $600, where does that go?
That just sits in the fund if they do not have any children. It's a reserve fund.
All right, so if they do have children,
then it goes directly to the custodial parent.
Okay, but that's a benefit from Social
Security.
For dependent children, correct?
Correct. For dependent children.
Okay. And so what the amendment is attempting to do is what?
In the state of Oregon, we are not getting full credit for the for that benefit going to our children because it goes directly to the child support.
So you're suggesting that the benefit derived from Social Security is the same as or should be offset from the obligation that a person might have for child support. You're basically saying it's one and the same.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yes. And what's happening in the courts, because the courts are not giving us credit for this benefit being paid on our behalf because of our disability, and it comes from our fund, and that money would not be there if we hadn't become disabled. We are actually paying double child support because the child support is being paid directly to the custodial parent. The court does not recognize that money. And then we have to go ahead and pay out of our own pocket, and they usually do this by garnishment reasons. They garnish our $1,000 to make up for the child support. So we're actually paying double child support. One of the cases I have in particular...
Yeah, Senator Ringo has a question.
What's the argument why the court doesn't give credit for them?
This has been an ongoing thing since 1990, Senator Ringo.
I understand, but if I talk to somebody on the other side of this, what are they going to say?
On benefits, right now they are giving us partial benefits only for this payment. They calculate it into a formula in the child support guidelines. But in the early 1990s, there was a case called Burge versus Burge and Smith versus Smith, had they brought this up and we wanted to have these benefits allowed as child support, and they came back and they decided at that time, no, these are children's benefits, therefore you are not going to be allowed to have these benefits at all, so therefore you will pay double the payments.
Senator Ringo.
I just want to understand that point. The Social Security benefits are considered to be benefits of the child. They're not benefits paid by the adult beneficiary to the child. They're direct benefits of the child. Is that the right way to put it?
Chairman, it's Senator Ringel. That is the way it was in the very beginning, in the early 90s. It has turned around and has changed. We are now getting partial credit for that. And I believe right here, Oregon law 461-200 states in their law that we cannot get credit for those payments if it doesn't go through Department of Human Services. And because the Social Security benefit is paid directly to the custodial parent, we're not getting full credit again. And one of the cases that I have in particular essence is this disabled veteran is his ex is receiving $26,262 a year in child support. He is only getting credit for $9,181, and he's in arrearage. So why should they benefit because of the disability of that person? She's getting double the money.
Well, what would stop an individual from going back to the court and asking for the child support order to be modified and take those issues into consideration?
I'm sorry.
Well, what would stop this person from asking to have a modification to the child support order and take into consideration those benefits?
They go by the child support guidelines, and right now they're not getting credit for it. Veterans' benefits were not included before to full extent.
But judges have discretion to take in other income and decide what child support is appropriate.
Oregon law forbids them right here under 461-200, unless it's paid through Department of Human Services, to allow that credit.
Well, don't judges consider other income in determining?
Not in all cases, they do not.
All right. Other questions? What would you have to say, Mr. Warnock?
There's two things that we'd really like to emphasize here. The children are getting the money that has been obligated to them, but the disabled, and our concern is for disabled veterans. Disabled veteran is not getting credit for that, though the children are getting what they need. And what that means is that our disabled vets are going in arrears on their obligation unnecessarily, and we think this could easily be solved by doing two things. One is allowing in our amendment on page 6, line 26, to put the word shall. So the courts will always take into consideration this particular issue with regard to disabled vets.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Burdick.
Which amendments are you going from?
A9.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Page 6, line 26. DOJ does have trouble with the word shall. I spoke to the Chief Justice yesterday and discussed this with him. And by the way, he appreciated DOJ's concern to keep the courts independent and let them make their decisions. But obviously, and he recognized that the legislature has the right to put the word shall in when it seems appropriate. And in our case, we think that the courts are being ambiguous with regard to the very confusing issues with regard to veterans' pensions, income, and the educational benefits that are provided on behalf of the disabled veteran for the children. And let's keep in mind that these payments would not be being made if these persons were not 100% disabled. They are disabled. And in the case of 100% disabled veterans, their educational benefits that are paid to the children on behalf of the parent who is disabled are not being credited. And what that means is we're putting our disabled vets in credit issues, huge credit problems. They're not able to earn additional income because they're disabled, because they're disabled veterans, and they're not getting the credit that they deserve. So we would like to see the word shall maintained in this amendment. And also, the other thing is DOJ wants, they agree to this, except for two issues, the word shall. And they would like to insert the word apportioned in front of veterans' benefits. And what that does to the disabled vet is keeps the educational benefit that's paid to the children on behalf of the disabled vet, keeps the educational benefit from being credited. In one case I'm aware of, it's a $680 a month payment that's made on behalf of the disabled vet, and this is only paid on behalf of 100% disabled veterans. When that payment is paid, we would like to see it credited, so it doesn't put our vets in arrearage further by another $680. So the courts are saying, you owe this money, but the children have received the money. That's the problem. We would like them to get credit for what has been paid, whether it's paid because they worked out in the workplace and earned the money and made that payment, or because they received a veteran's benefit because they're a 100% disabled vet. If that money is then paid, we would like to see credit for that. There is no way for these guys to go out and earn additional income and to get caught up from their arrearages. There's no way. It's impossible. So we have a horrible catch-22 system here that affects primarily 100% disabled veterans. And we think that's an injustice.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Warnock, just to be clear, what the educational benefits that the VA pays, the disabled veteran wants that to be considered as child support and not just an educational benefit. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's a benefit paid on behalf of the disabled vet.
Right.
It goes toward the children, toward the child's educational purpose, and we would like to see that attached to the obligation. Absolutely. It would be if the parent was not disabled and was making educational payments for that child, giving it to the parent or giving it in form of child support that could be used for education, it would be calculated as part of that obligation. In a 100% disabled vet's case, it is not calculated as part of the obligation. That's an injustice.
All right. Senator Walker.
So in a normal divorce situation where you're not involving anybody who's disabled or has Social Security benefits, say my husband and I got divorced, mm-hmm. my husband paid $600 a month for my children to go to college, that's included in the calculation of child support that he owes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, that's true.
But with disabled veterans, it's not.
That's correct.
Bingo. Thank you.
Chairman, if I may expound on that, what is proposed in the guidelines is the word apportionment. And if that word apportionment does stay in the wording of the new guidelines, that specifically excludes that benefit for those veterans where their child goes on to school. Because according to United States Code, Chapter 38, it specifically states the VA will not apportion educational assistance, and this is what this benefit is considered. When a person is 100% permanent and disabled veteran, then they have this benefit only if they're permanent and total. That's when this educational benefit comes into effect. But to make it work and get it into the program, they call it a Chapter 35 educational benefit due to this permanent disabled veteran's disability. But he has to be permanent and total.
All right, time out. Who are you?
My name is John Roach. I'm from Beaverton, Oregon.
What do you have to add to this conversation, John?
I basically, this was started almost 3 sessions ago. Senator Walker probably remembers me.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it dealt with Social Security issues at the time because it was the state of Oregon wouldn't recognize Social Security benefits paid directly to a custodial parent as a form of child support, which really in the calculation figures worked against as a disabled person. If you were custodial or non-custodial parent, it worked against you financially. State, for example, in the state of Washington, any money that was paid to a child or death benefit paid to a child by a Social Security department must recognize this legal support in a dollar-for-dollar standard. Oregon in 99 changed their calculation and allowed part of the Social Security to be paid in. But it was added into the major figure, which raised the dollar amount, which still made the disabled person pay in a double payment. If you were a custodial mother and had a child, it worked against you because all of a sudden you didn't get a full credit in there, and the non-custodial parent had to pay less. Coming down to the veterans benefits, we try to get the veterans benefits recognized, and what they have said here is true. You have to be 100% permanent and total. That means you're not going to get better. You're not going to have anything to be able to go back out in the workforce again and earn the money. And if your child wants to go to college, this benefit is paid, and it should be accredited as a form of monetary support for that child. Just like there again, we can't go out and change and make more money.
I'm the chair. I get a direct traffic.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm just wondering who opposes the concept that you're advocating? Does the family law section oppose it? Where's the opposition coming from?
I think the Department of Justice.
Perhaps. Is it DOJ?
Yes.
We're going to hear from them in just a second.
All right.
I think we've got this issue here among y'all. For a second. I want to bring the Department of Justice up and have them respond.
Mr. Chairman, may I say one more thing? Most states allow this. Oregon's one of the few states that does not allow this type of credit. Most other states do. So we're trying to bring Oregon in line with the rest of the country, and would like to see this benefit. By the way, both of these gentlemen are 100% disabled vets.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Department of Justice, who wants to respond?
Again, for the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice. As I said at the beginning of my testimony, the reason we often have a housekeeping bill is the child support laws are technical and are complex, and the A9 amendments are a good example of some of the confusion around our laws. Trying to be brief for you, I would cover these points based on what I heard. The law as it's drafted is not just for 100% disabled. It's veterans benefits and Social Security benefits, but it's a broader spectrum because we have all types of parents in our caseload. So that may be somewhat misleading. Not everyone, my understanding is not everyone on Social Security benefits, at least. I can't speak to the veterans, but would not necessarily only be the 100% disabled. So a point of clarification. The other piece that I don't know was real clear to you is this. It is true that prior to the 99 session, the child support program in Oregon was not allowing a credit for these payments. In 99, that law was changed by the House and the Senate Judiciary Committees, and now we allow a pro rata or a partial credit for those payments. At the time, that was based on case law, that was based on thinking among the state's child support programs and several other factors. Last session, we worked with some of these advocates and a legislator and looked at another approach to allowing a credit, so not a guidelines calculation, but a credit. It simply ran out of time and did not succeed last session. The A9 amendments that you have before you, we have not agreed to all of them. We did share these amendments with the Oregon Veterans Association and said we need some changes in order to meet the needs of all of our customers. It's not all the way there. Another brief point, some disabled customers, probably not the two gentlemen that came to the table, but some of our customers do have other assets. Even if they're not working, it does not mean they don't hold rental property, they don't have other forms of income. And so we're trying to maintain enough flexibility that all of the cases in the caseload can be met by this law, not just a narrow few. I know that the Judicial Department has some concerns about that discretionary piece and keeping it broad enough that we can meet all of the cases and all of the concerns. The judges do, of course, have the ability to do what's called a rebuttal, to consider factors and still decide something different, basically, as you said, Chairman, it's based on individual case factors. The only other thing I would say, unless you have specific questions you'd like me to answer, is this is much bigger than housekeeping. We would have been happy to work with these constituents on House Bill 3472. For whatever reason, that did not occur in time in the House chamber. I don't know that this fits in this bill that we have at least shared with the House chamber as a housekeeping, and now this is a fairly substantive change. Nancy Miller from the Judicial Department is here if you have any questions about the Chief Justice's comments or the court's concerns.
Senator Bridge.
I just had a question on the decision to allow partial credit for benefits. Why wasn't the whole benefit that's earmarked for children, why wasn't the whole thing considered?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, at the time, the case law and looking at the other states and information from the federal government, that was the current thinking, if you will, the current policy approach that was taken to allow pro rata, but that wasn't a complete replacement for your child support. I should mention a very, very important piece. That the guidelines of
just hang on one second. Mm-hmm. I know that it's not, if the situation justifies higher child support, I can understand that, but why only give, as I understood your use of the word partial, that only a portion of that $600 would be credited? Why not credit the whole amount and then maybe say, well, that's still not sufficient? I could understand that, but only crediting part of the amount makes no sense to me.
Chairman, Senator Burdick, I apologize. We are not opposed to the dollar-for-dollar credit. Those aren't the concerns in the amendments. There are other pieces in the amendments, and I didn't speak to what our concerns are. And, in fact, the child support guidelines, the rules that were referred to by the earlier testimony, that go into effect on May 12th, because we just went through a major review of the guidelines, will put in place by rule a dollar-for-dollar credit. So the program has changed based on updates in case law, current thinking, policies around the state. So we are moving in that direction. This bill would strive to put that and lock that into statute, so to speak. That's not the piece we have issues with. The piece we have issues with, just briefly to tell you, are there is a section in here that was intended when it was drafted to be on page 6 of their A9 amendments to be a credit specifically for retroactive payments. They've taken out that language and turned it into an ongoing credit. We oppose that because, as Chairman has said, there are modifications and other remedies available. And the other piece is changing the may to a shall, just because that takes away some of the discretion. Those are our concerns that are left.
And I think one of the issues in my mind is that these are really judicial decisions. And my assumption is that a judge takes into account the resources of the various parties and makes a determination based on what, in their opinion, is sufficient to meet the needs of the child.
Chairman, that is how it is supposed to work, yes.
Senator Ringo.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't do family law, but there's some pretty definitive support guidelines that they put in the income of one parent, the income of the other parent, the number of kids, are there any special needs, are they in college, medical expenses, and they throw it all in and out comes a number. And then they're supposed to award that number unless there's a compelling reason why, maybe for some reason for this family, that number's not the right number, and it should be either higher or lower. So, yes, there's discretion, but it really is supposed to be within the confines of that formula. But it still doesn't explain to me why there should not be the dollar-for-dollar offset. And it sounds to me like you do agree with the concept of the dollar-for-dollar offset.
Mm-hmm.
And these gentlemen think that it's important to have that in statute, and I'm just wondering why you're unable to accommodate some of their technical concerns, and we can just put it in statute.
Chairman, Senator Ringo, you're absolutely correct. The guidelines are supposed to be the presumed child support, and then there are opportunities to deviate. And we are changing the guidelines to make the dollar-for-dollar credit a part of that standard upfront calculation. So you're right, we're on board. I got notice of these amendments yesterday, less than 24 hours. We haven't had time to work through our other issues. If you could just pull out the dollar-for-dollar credit, that would be fine. There's a lot more than that in these A9s, and that would be my concern.
I see. Well, Mr. Carr?
Senator Ringo.
I would like to see that, to me, the dollar-for-dollar credit makes sense. And it's nice that now they're going into the rule. But I do wonder whether it makes sense also to codify it, and whether some of these other concerns should get in the way of that.
Senator Minister Ringo, excuse me, Chairman, Senator Ringo just about promoted you. That certainly is a policy decision for the committee. Our only concern is this really the appropriate bill? We would need to do some clear discussion back with the House chamber to add something this substantive.
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Schenkel, we've been dealing with this since 1999. I was very involved with this with Representative Witt and Representative Lowe, and we're still here in 2003, and I'm just a bit frustrated that you indicate that you would have been happy to work with them. Why aren't you people working on this in the interim, or are you? And are we just now getting this information now? I just don't understand. If it's this outstanding issue, why aren't you working with these folks in the interim?
Chair Minnis and Senator Walker, we are. The remedy we had during the interim was through the rulemaking process, and those are about to go into effect. I know at least that the constituent, Mr. Hoyman, was involved in the guidelines process. I'm not sure whether or not Mr. Roach was. But that is our form that we have available. I also had discussions with Mr. Hoyman early in the interim. He indicated he would like to do this again this session. I said, please share your draft with us so we can make sure you get the parts that we've agreed to in the past and you don't put back in the pieces we can't live with. That didn't happen, and I simply didn't have time yesterday to get that far. I apologize.
All right.
I see them shaking their heads in the back of the room in the negative, so I think there's some disagreement.
That's why we're here. Okay. Well, I think with this, I'm going to hold this thing over a little bit, and there seems to be some interest in trying to address some of these issues. So we'll close the public hearing on 2110, bring that back at some future date. And, Bill, am I done with all of your bills?
Yes.
Okay. And so hopefully Mr. Joseph is listening and running as fast as he can to the committee.
Well, I'll stay here until I come.
Great. Anybody out there want to give a speech or anything? Oh, truth verification. Let's do this real quick. We need to bring back a little work session on Senate Bill 356. The issue here is that this bill did have a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, so we would need a motion to reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 356 for the purpose of rescinding or including in our motion setting for a request to rescind the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Chairman, I so move.
Okay, Senator Burdick moves that we reconsider the vote by which we passed out Senate Bill 356 for the purpose of removing the referral to Ways and Means consent of the Senate President. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion? So ordered. And Senator Burdick.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we request that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means of Senate Bill 356 be rescinded.
All right, Senator Burdick moves Senate Bill 356 to the floor of the Senate with a request of the Senate President for the subsequent referral to Ways and Means Committee to be removed. Is there any objection to the motion? Discussion? No objection? Motion passes, and whoever was carrying it before will carry it again. All right. Senate Bill 611. Mr. Joseph is not yet here.
Senator Corcoran is carrying 356.
Senator Corcoran is? Okay, Senator Corcoran will carry his bill, assuming the Senate President consents in the sending of the motion. Well, let's do this.
Aha!
Aha! Yes, good. What would I do without my attorney?
$500.
I knew you worked for one of those highfalutin firms.
All right, so what are we doing?
Let's do 611. We've already done 356 and reconsidered it and requested a subsequent. Let's do 611. Let's do 611, a little work session on that one.
I'm going to give you an update. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you recall, Senate Bill 611 dealt with filing an initial affidavit when you sued a professional, a design professional, an architect or an engineer. The affidavit would say that you as the claimant have consulted with an expert who has looked at the evidence available to you and has deemed that the claim has merit. Last time we heard this bill, there were some concerns about essentially the people who don't have access to the materials that could give to a consulting expert to find out whether the claim has merit or not. And the examples that were given were a person walking down the street beside new construction and a brick falls on them. They're not going to have access to the plans or to any of the documentary evidence or subpoena power for witnesses before filing a claim that they can give to an expert to get an affidavit saying the claim has merit. The other situation would be a laborer, a person who's essentially lumping the lumber back and forth. They're not going to have access, if they're hurt on the job site, to the plans or any subpoena power. And so what we did in the Dash 4 amendments, which I understand are consensus amendments, are we added a Section 3 at the end. Maybe it's a Section 5, if I could find my appropriate set here.
I have two sections.
Here they are. If you look at Section 5 on page 2, starting on line 19.
Subsection 5 or Section 1?
Right, subsection 5, correct. It says that this section applies to only those persons, and it gives a bunch of list of people. And what we tried to do was think of all the people that would, or entities that would generally have access to the plans, those being the contractor, any other construction design professionals, the owner or the occupier, be it a lease or a renter of the building, or someone who has actually hired the person who is being sued. So that's the list that you see in Section 5, and that kind of gets rid of or excludes those people from the provisions of the measure who would not have access to these materials absent filing a suit.
All right. Senator Rigo?
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to thank Senator Roberts and Marshall Kober for being so patient and working through the compromise. I think from the standpoint of the trial bar, there really isn't anything to be gained by going in this direction by allowing for such an affidavit. But on the other hand, I think there is a legitimate purpose for these folks in terms of trying to reduce the number of lawsuits against architects or engineers that may not be well-founded, where they may not have consulted with somebody to really say that this is professional negligence. So if it helps do that, I'm very happy to support it, and I will support it. Okay. The only other thing I want to say is that I think this architects and engineer liability is rather unique. It's an unusual type of case. There's a very small number of cases, and it probably makes sense to move in this direction for architects and engineers. But I strongly urge the committee not to look at this as the first step towards a broader expert discovery requiring disclosure of affidavits, because I think moving in that direction really will hinder the ability of somebody to bring a claim.
All right.
So, but I very much support this this version, and I do commend Ms. Roberts and Mr. Kova for their work on this.
All right, great. Well said, and your caution is heeded. All right, Senator Ringo, would you be so kind as to move the Dash 4?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 611.
All right, Senator Ringo moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 611. Is there any discussion? Objections? No objection. Motion passes. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 611 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Burdick now moves Senate Bill 611 as amended before the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objections to the motion? Motion passes. Senator Ringo, would you carry that?
Glad to.
Thank you very much. And you can make that same admonition on the floor if you'd like. All right. We're having fun now, aren't we? Let's see. We could almost do it as a late night show or something. We'll put everybody to sleep.
That's tomorrow night.
That's tomorrow night in the House. Yeah. Oh, by the way, for the committee, on Monday, since the Senate President has issued an edict to get all of our House bills at least first heard by Monday the 28th, we're going to have a little marathon in mass work session, or no, just public hearing. We're going to be pumping these things out.
Mr. Chair, yes. Will they be scheduled only for public hearing or also for possible work session?
Only for public hearing. You know, I'm not going to surprise anybody with anything.
Okay.
It's just, you know, it's a procedural thing to make sure that the bills are alive and continue to be so until they're dead. All right. House Bill 2272. What do we have for this one? Mr. Livingston, you've been patiently waiting out there. Tell me these are all consensus amendments and everybody's happy.
Yes. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Michael Livingston, Department of Justice. 2272 is a bill drafted and proposed by the Oregon Law Commission Juvenile Code Work Group to fix a problem with 419B917. In a nutshell, that statute, 419B917, requires that a summons be served on a parent for each stage of a termination of parental rights proceeding. That was not the intent of the drafters of that. In fact, the intent was to preserve the summons practices that existed in the counties throughout the state prior to its enactment. What 2272 does initially and primarily is to bring back the practice that existed before the enactment of 419B917, which is to require a service of summons only once in the proceeding. Thereafter, if there are future appearances required by the parent is ordered either in writing or verbally on the record to appear again for further proceedings, and the parent is also notified of the consequences of the failure to not appear. In addition to that change, House Bill 2272 also provides uniform summons requirements for jurisdictional proceedings and proceedings for permanent guardianship. There are two amendments, the -2 and the -5. The -2 adds an emergency clause to the bill so that the change can be implemented upon passage. The -5 makes a clarification that if the court in a particular county does not direct which form of response to a summons is required, then the summons shall require a written answer. Just a brief bit of explanation. Under the bill and under the law that existed prior to 419B917, the court really, or the summons, could require any one of three different responses. One, a written answer. Two, a personal appearance before the court to admit or deny the petition. Or three, appearance before the court for a trial on the petition. Those options are preserved in House Bill 2272, and the court in each county has the authority to direct which one of those responses the parent shall make. In the absence of that direction, the summons is going to require a written answer. The other benefit of this bill, I should say, is that it will save the state money, because under the current law, as I said, a summons must be served upon parents at each stage of a termination of parental rights proceeding. Now, under the bill, it would be served only one time.
Do we know how much money it saves?
Just not in amount, just anecdotally, because what this would do is, under the current law, not only would we be saving the amount it costs to prepare and serve a summons more than once, which would include the county sheriff savings, and would also include savings to the Department of Human Resources and the Department of Justice, but also the court time that it takes to have actual personal appearance at these hearings instead of a written answer. So the dollar amount is not known, but just those procedures would no longer be required.
All right. Questions by the committee? Any questions? There are no questions. Excellent job.
Thank you.
All righty. Is everybody happy with this thing? Anyone want to take some time to read it and digest it and contemplate it?
Mr. Chair, I'd move it.
Kind of jerk them around a little bit. No? Okay.
Let's have a study group.
Yeah, there you go. We're in work session. Senator Ringo now moves House Bill 2272. Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Excuse me. That's right. We do. We need Senator Ringo, with your consent, the -2 and -5 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill or -2 and -5 amendments to Senate. House Bill 2272.
All right. Senator Ringo moves the adoption of the Dash 2 and Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2272. Is there any discussion? Objections? There are none. Motion passed.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ringo.
I move House Bill 2272 to the floor with a two-pass recommendation as amended. And that Senator Walker can help.
Senator Ring, code moves the House Bill 2272 is amended. He sent to the floor of the Senate with a two-pass recommendation, and that Senator Walker carry the bill. Discussion? Any objections? We'll expect a complete and full discussion on these issues.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair.
No objection? Thank you very much. We have one bill left, I believe. A good one. This is good. Laws governing garnishments.
Yeah, my favorite topic.
And we have our own illustrious counsel, Mr. Hendricks, here to open a public hearing on House Bill 2274.
Mr. Chair, would anybody in the room be angry if we change the amounts? No, I'm only kidding.
Okay, Mr. Hendricks.
Chairman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. House Bill 2274 is another bill coming to you from the Oregon Law Commission. You may remember last session that there was a very large and extensive rewrite of the garnishment laws, and the work group that had put that together went on to prepare another large bill relating to judgments, and while they were at it, took a look at how last session's bill was working. They found a couple of small glitches that they wanted to repair, and they also had some additional things that didn't fall in the category of glitches but fell in the category of additional improvements to the process. House Bill 2274 contains the work group's product. You should have a report that accompanies it that's a section by section for those who are really interested in this sort of thing, which I suspect is not a lot of people. I will just mention a couple of the largest thing real quickly that the bill does. The pre-existing law had never explained whether or not you could serve a garnishment on that only a single writ that covered two debtors, and the law will now be clear that you can, in fact, use a single writ of garnishment for two joint debtors and provide some rules on how that will work. It clears up one little problem created by the bill last session about the authority of the sheriff to enter property, to seize property under certain writs. That need to be cleared up. There's another bill coming along from the Sheriff's Association that will expand on this a bit more that's either been passed by the House or will be passed by the House here shortly. It kind of cleared up just a few of the other procedural things. It allows either the service of an original or a copy of the writ instead of original and a copy. And that gives you some idea about the level of, these are primarily little fixes within the process rather than major changes to the garnishment process. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. I just have one question for Mr. Marquis. Is my friend Ron Smith happy with this? Thank you very much. Just for the committee, Ron Smith is a fellow who owns a business who does a lot of garnishment serving in. Basically told me a bunch of the bar and a bunch of lawyers got together and tried to figure out how to fix the garnishment statutes, but created huge headaches in terms of his process and ability to actually accomplish the objective. So that's why I wanted to know if we're actually fixing this, because I don't want to have to listen to Mr. Smith say, it's in your committee, you mucked it up, Mr. Chairman. And he's peachy with this. Okay. Right, if you do get served in the garnishment, more likely than not, you did get served by his company, just so you know. But. All right, question, Senator Walker.
I do have a question of Mr. Hendricks. This was my issue in 99, trying to get at people who are independent contractors and self-employed, and we were trying to work the statutes so that they could exempt some of their income when they filed bankruptcy, just like anybody else who's a wage earner. And there was an attempt to do that. They couldn't do that. Was that addressed in this rewrite?
Chairman, Senator Walker, it was not. Although I will say that the work group is going to continue on during this coming interim, and because As part of the big judgments bill, we left open two areas that the group was going to return to. One was how the court goes about selling property, because there's a bunch of old statutes we didn't even try to dive into for that project. And the other one is the exemption statute. So I suspect as part of the work group process during the coming interim, they're going to be looking at those statutes relating to wage exemptions and other exemptions.
Okay. It truly is an unfair situation for people who are self-employed when they're not allowed to exempt certain earnings, such as a wage earner is. So I do hope. Are you involved in the work group?
I don't think I can escape.
Get out of it. I know it's really a very difficult area of law. I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Other questions? Senator Ringo, anything? Great. Excellent. We want to hold on with this thing or walk around with it, play with it?
No?
Okay. Work session, House Bill 2274. Senator Ringo.
Chair, I move House Bill 2274 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Ringo moves House Bill 2274 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, just one. I just hope that since they've rewritten this and spent a lot of time on it, that they do continue to look at the exemption issue. I've been told over and over that it's impossible to do, but this was not impossible, so I'm going to dog the Law Commission and ask that they figure out a way.
Maybe you can get appointed to the Law Commission as a member or whatever. I think we have, don't we have a legislator on that? Or do you have to be, a member of the bar?
I don't know if you have to be a member of the bar. I know that there are legislators.
Uh-huh. There are legislators on there, but they're members of the bar.
I see lots of head shaking back there.
All right. Okay. No further discussion on the motion? Motion passes. And let me see. Senator Walker, I'll let you carry this thing.
Okay.
Then you can mention your other issue.
Yeah.
All right. Any other business before the committee? Thank you for your attendance, your indulgence, et cetera. Adjourned.
Did we...